The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we thank them for their support. Today we're reading from the October edition of Smithsonian. Our first article is under the justice category, and it's called The Drive for Equality by Martin J. Kernan. How Florence St. John and her co-workers at General Motors set the precedent for equal pay in the 1930s. By 1938, there wasn't a job Florence St. John hadn't done in the raucous sheet metal department at the Olds Motor Works in Lansing, Michigan, where around 300 workers at 70 or so Behemoth machines punched, drilled, welded, and riveted old Oldsmobile parts. St. John stepped onto the factory floor for the first time in 1928, joining around 30 other women in the overwhelming male trade. The 32-year-old mother of three worked elbow to elbow with the men, levering heavy presses to bend and cut steel. In the 1930s, managers at the Olds Motor Works, a division of General Motors, treated St. John and other women with the same as men in nearly all but one respect: pay. St. John first discovered a pay disparity during games of check pool, a form of poker that the workers played with their paychecks to entertain themselves on the factory floor. Time after time, St. John and the other women noticed a pattern. Men on the same shifts with similar jobs and less seniority, some of whom the women had trained, appeared to be making more. This curious game of chance would eventually tip the scales at trial and result in the first major damages award in a job discrimination case in U.S. history. A critical but largely forgotten struggle that inspired women and legislatures across the country to take up the cause of equal pay. Lower pay didn't mean lighter loads for the women, who, among other duties, had to drag around huge pans full of car parts, weighing up to 200 pounds, often without assistance. If they didn't meet strictly enforced quotas, the men and women knew they would lose their jobs. In the heavy press room, St. John worked with women, including her friend Moretta Cobb, and men, as the workers wrenched together strips of steel to make an elaborate part called a harmonic balancer, a sturdy 5-pound disc that absorbs vibrations that would otherwise damage the engine. In assembling the balancers, the women were themselves equal to men in strength, skill, and grit, as attested by their male co-workers. There was a sense they were all in it together. Check pool eroded this sense by revealing that GM paid men $15 to $20 more per pay period. In late 1936, as strikes erupted at GM plants in nearby Flint, Michigan, in response to poor working conditions and hundreds of workers' deaths, St. John began urging Forrest Brown, her co-worker, and a union representative to help the women close the pay gap. Brown repeatedly confronted GM managers with an obscure criminal law, Michigan Penal Code Number 328, Section 556, that made it a misdemeanor to discriminate in any way in the payment of wages as between sexes. But GM wouldn't budge, with one manager telling Brown if it were up to him, he wouldn't have any women working in his department. When Brown took a position with the Michigan Department of Labor and Industry the following year, he investigated the Olds Motor Works for violation of the statute. By then, GM, in an attempt to comply with the statute, had parked St. John and others in a newly created women's division, where they ostensibly did lower skilled work like sorting bolts, but where they still found themselves bound to do more intensive jobs, such as making harmonic balancers. Most of the women bridled at the segregated arrangement and continued low pay, $0.76 an hour to a comparable skilled man's $0.97, and many women quit. For reasons that aren't clear, Brown dropped the investigation. At trial, St. John recalled the moment as a crucial turning point in rallying her fellow workers at a meeting in their homes. In March 1938, they decided, as St. John put it, to see Mr. Pierce, that is, Bernard Pierce, a prominent civic-minded Lansing attorney. Pierce and his partner, Joseph Blank, had made headlines in the local newspapers as successful trial lawyers, but weren't known as civil rights specialists. Nonetheless, the pair devised a legal maneuver to transfer 28 other women's claims to St. John, then filed a lawsuit that prefigured modern class actions. Thus, on April 7, 1938, St. John took the unprecedented step of suing GM on her own behalf and that of her women co-workers for back pay. Never, it appears, had any group of women banded together in this fashion and demanded damages for lost wages. GM answered by preemptively attacking the constitutionality of the Michigan law upon which St. John's case now hinged. An ensuing three-year legal battle culminated in the decision by the Michigan Supreme Court to uphold the 20-year-old statute, which no one had ever sought to enforce until then. Having ruled that St. John and Company had standing for their suit, the High Court sent the case to the Ingham County Circuit Court for trial, where the burden was on St. John to prove there was a pay disparity. The trial began on June 2, 1941, before Judge Charles Hayden in an ornate courtroom that today still occupies the third floor of the Ingham County Courthouse in the town of Mason, just outside Lansing. The women girded themselves for a trial that would consume six oppressively hot weeks, see some 70 witnesses testify, and receive in evidence more than 10,000 exhibits. Beginning with St. John, the women told of their pay history as compared with the men's, of men and women side by side doing the same heavy and technically demanding work, of the cooperative atmosphere on the production floor. St. John and Moretta Cobb told the judge how they had to do their heavy assembly work at unimaginable speed, cranking out one harmonic balancer about every 30 seconds to meet their quota up to 105 per hour. It was one of the heavier operations, their foreman admitted at the trial, referring to the harmonic balancers, an admission that undermined GM's claim that women did only lighter work, thus meriting lower pay. As the days wore on, the women watched numerous GM foremen and managers testify that men were more versatile, stronger, able to work longer, and at night, easier to train and more mechanically inclined. The managers said St. John and other women had complained about the difficulty of their jobs, that foremen had ordered women not to lift heavy loads, that the company had hired men whose only job was to help the women. The women even had a hot plate in a break room, the managers protested, which GM had reluctantly allowed the women to use after St. John had smuggled it in. GM's lawyer, Jacob Tolan, argued strenuously week after week that the plaintiffs couldn't prove they were paid less on the basis of sex because, he claimed, they weren't. Finally, Plank convinced Judge Hayden to make GM cough up payroll records, initially withheld to protect GM's right against self-incrimination. Court was delayed a half hour while the cartons of time and rate cards, canceled checks, and other pertinent materials was carried up three flights of stairs, the Lansing State Journal reported. The proof of pay discrimination was thus laid bare on counsel's table. Judge Hayden found for the plaintiffs, and on May 29, 1942, the case made national news. 29 women win $55,690 in wage equality ruling, the New York Times announced. 3 years of GM appeals later, on January 2, 1945, the women were awarded $55,690, close to $1 million in today's money. By then, the plant had been refitted for war production, and equal pay for women at America's wartime factories had been the rule since 1942. That groundbreaking feat was made possible by Mary Elizabeth Pidgeon and Mary Anderson of the Department of Labor's Women's Bureau in Washington, D.C., who used St. John's court victory to convince the War Labor Board to equalize pay rates between men and women, which it did on November 24 of that year. David Engstrom, a professor at Stanford Law School who brought the case back to light in 2017 while tracing the origins of employee class action lawsuits, outlined in a 2018 Stanford Law Review article how St. John's remarkable success inspired other women in Michigan to sue for wage discrimination and spurred legislatures in 21 other states to pass wage equality bills before the Equal Pay Act of 1963. Of all the state's bills, however, Engstrom found that only two, Massachusetts in 1945 and Oregon in 1955, actually offered provisions that would allow women to sue for equal pay in court. At the time, many labor leaders saw courts as a threat to union sovereignty in the workplace. Engstrom writes, therefore, lobbied against many of these bills. Ruth Milkman, professor of sociology at the City University of New York Graduate Center, writes that after World War II, employers and lobbyists for business groups also played a role in weakening equal pay laws at both the state and federal level. Engstrom says revisiting St. John's case can help scholars and policymakers better understand the roles women and organized labor can play in defending workers' rights, though he has written that it was almost certainly the first significant damages payout in a job discrimination case in the case history of U.S. law. Engstrom says that Florence St. John versus General Motors Corporation has limited value as a legal precedent for civil rights lawyers today because it is confined to Michigan law. It was also curiously forgotten, including by the media, when the newly formed Equal Employment Opportunity Commission recompensed an underpaid typist in 1968 who had been denied a promotion at one of GM's parts manufacturers, the Detroit Free Press declared. She wins $885 and makes history. St. John died 2 years later, on December 21, 1970. Engstrom imagines that sometime during those 2 years, as a recently widowed snowbird returning to Michigan from Daytona Beach to visit her two grown daughters, St. John may have seen the Detroit Free Press headline and smiled. Here's a sidebar of 5 women who were involved. Elizabeth Duncan Kuntz, 1919 to 1989. Kuntz is best known as a pioneer for equality in education. She served as the first black head of the National Education Association, where she established the teaching union's Human and Civil Rights Division. In 1969, she became the first black director of the U.S. Women's Bureau. Mary Anderson, 1872 to 1964. She directed the Women's Bureau at the Department of Labor, where she campaigned for equal pay and equal opportunities on behalf of more than 6 million women who took jobs in factories during World War II. And these are called the change makers, these 5 women. Mary Van Kleek, K-L-E-E-C-K, 1883 to 1972. A tenacious researcher, Van Cleek published a groundbreaking report in 1918 that laid bare women's overlong, underpaid hours. It was later adapted into the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, which established a federal minimum wage and a standard work week and outlawed child labor. Freda Miller, as director of the U.S. Women's Bureau from 1944 to 1953, Miller saw that many women wanted to keep working when men came home from World War II, and she helped them realize that dream. As a result, while 3.25 million women did lose their jobs at the end of the war, 2.75 million found new work. Mary Elizabeth Pidgeon, raised a Quaker in Virginia, she became chief of the Women's Bureau's Economic Studies section in the 1940s, compiling dozens of reports, one of which spurred laws in several states extending minimum wage and maximum hour protections to minority women in service industries. And at the end of the reading is a short blurb. It says, read about the women who fought for equal pay during World War I at smithsonianmag.com/equity. Up next, breaking the barrier. The speeding bullet design that propelled Chuck Yeager into history. And this is written by Jeff McGregor. And there's a picture of the plane, I think, at least a replica of it, that broke the sound barrier. It's kind of orange and has the Air Force markings on it. From the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, Udvar-Hazy Center. And the Udvar-Hazy Center, if I may add, is almost bigger than it may even be bigger than the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in downtown D.C., but the Udvar-Hazy Center is, about 5 or 10 miles outside of D.C. Don't count on the mileage. It's a bit out there, but it's very, very good to see. It was arguably the most important flight since Kitty Hawk, and the plane was a perfection of form and function. 30 feet 9 inches long, 10 feet 8.5 inches high, and 28 feet from wingtip to razor-sharp wingtip. The Bell X-1 looked exactly like what had inspired its designers, a 50-caliber bullet. Square-jawed, slender and handsome, with a reassuring, laconic West Virginia drawl, U.S. Air Force Captain Chuck Yeager sat in the cockpit as the UR pilot, the epitome of the right stuff. On this bright, brisk morning near Rogers Dry Lake in Southern California, October 14, 1947, he was preparing to fly faster than the speed of sound for the first time in recorded history. Yeager, a 24-year-old ace fighter pilot turned path-breaking test pilot, was operating the most sophisticated aeronautical science package ever built. Everything that wasn't Yeager in this tiny cockpit was fuel or wiring or instrumentation. Thousands of pounds of it, all propelled forward in a deafening rush by a rocket engine producing 6,000 pounds of thrust. The program had made dozens of preparatory flights before Yeager eased his throttle forward into history. Larry Bell, head of Bell Aircraft, his chief design engineer, Robert Woods, Ezra Kochner, and then Army aviator and John Stack, a research scientist at the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, had been working for years on supersonic flight. One particular challenge was determining how to fly through the buffeting of the transonic zone, the liminal space between subsonic and supersonic speed, where the very air was the enemy, compressing itself against the plane's skin, and where the sound barrier was said to be. A joint project by the National Committee for Aeronautics, NACA, I'll call it NACA, a joint project of NACA and the U.S. Army Air Forces, built by Bell Aircraft of Buffalo, New York. The X-1 reached a speed of 700 miles per hour that bright day, Mach 1.06 at an altitude of 43,000 feet. This was no headline-grabbing joyride. It was top-secret research. Still, by December 1947, newspapers and magazines had the story, and the National Aeronautic Association awarded Bell, Stack, and Yeager with that year's Collier Trophy, one of the highest prizes in aviation. Once the X-1 made headlines, Hollywood was keen to give audiences a front-row seat to the supersonic frontier. Indeed, the X-1's final flight in 1950 was a cameo in Howard Hughes' Jet Pilot, a movie starring John Wayne and Janet Leigh, which hit the theaters with a thud in 1957. The X-1 landed at the Smithsonian in 1950. In presenting the aircraft to Alexander Wetman, then the Smithsonian secretary, Air Force Chief of Staff Hoyt Vandenberg said Yeager's flight that day in 1947 had marked the end of the first great period of the air age and the beginning of the second. In a few moments, the subsonic period became history, and the supersonic period was born. Yeager retired from the armed services in 1975 as a general and visited his old ship at the Smithsonian when he could on the anniversary of their signature flight. After Tom Wolfe published The Right Stuff in 1979 and the big-budget film adaptation arrived in 1983, those visits became rock star Q&A events. Crowds would fill the National Air and Space Museum's Samuel P. Langley Theater and spill out into the planetarium. And then 400 or 500 or 600 fans would line up for autographs. To the amazement of the curators, Yeager, who always had to be the fastest, could sign 500 autographs in less than 30 minutes. Today, visitors can see the X-1 at the museum's Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center in Virginia. Despite early hopes, supersonic civilian aircraft like the Concorde proved economically unsustainable. High fuel and maintenance costs and too much noise compared with subsonic flight. Yet today, several startups are trying again. There was always a powerful appeal in post-war notions of supersonic flight when a machine like the X-1 promised something like freedom or escape. An imagined life so fast and so high and so clean that nothing bad could ever catch us again. But the unspoken promise of every technology is the one it can't deliver, transcendence. Non-military flight eventually became a commercial tedium, a series of shoeless corrals leading to a subsonic middle seat, a subpar romantic comedy, and a lost suitcase. Global air travel is a miracle when you stop and think about it, but no one does. Instead, we've made the very angels ordinary, and when there are no more firsts, we're left with nothing but our own contempt for the familiar. Faster, even than a rocket, is how quickly the future becomes the past. But once long ago, on a blue October morning, under the impossible vaults of heaven, one of us rose and flew faster than the roar of our own hopes, and for a moment, everything seemed possible. And we'll wrap it up with Paper Trail by Eric Hansen, unearthing the long-lost secrets of the country's earliest inventions. The fire bled upward from the cellar and swelled to an inferno overnight. Buckets and hoses proved no match for the blaze. A horrified crowd assembled outside Blodgett's Hotel, where the U.S. Patent Office shared space with the Post Office, and the sun rose on December 15, 1836, to find the entirety of the nation's intellectual property records turned to ash. Around 10,000 patents in total, Every invention registered with the government since 1790. After the fire, the Patent Office, now the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, implored inventors to send in their original documentation to be duplicated. That effort formally ended in 1847, and to this day, only around 2,845 of the lost patents have been fully replicated in the agency's records. But the agency has revived the rescue plan, and it's going brilliantly. Most notable among the recent discoveries are two, authenticated this summer, belonging to 19th century steamboat magnate Robert Fulton. The papers, dating from 1809 and 1811, are Fulton's own signed original copies of the patents. These were crucial in helping Fulton protect and expand the country's first commercially successful steamboat enterprise, which he founded in 1807. The two patents are housed at the U.S. Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis, Maryland. Alex Rowland, a retired Duke University history professor who is writing a Fulton biography, and St. John Courtenay III, a patent judge, whom Rowland met in the course of his research, brought the patents to the Patent Office's attention. These two represent iconic ex-patents, says Adam Bisnow, who became the agency's first official historian in 2020 and went on to formalize and expand the recovery initiative. Many of the records destroyed in 1836 are known as ex-patents. They predated the patent numbering system and were retroactively assigned numbers appended with an X. The Fultons are now known as 995X and 1434X. Bisnow believes more ex-patents could be similarly hidden in plain sight in public and private collections. They might even be framed on people's walls, just as examples of Americana. Collectors needn't worry about surrendering a treasure, though. Patent officials need only a high-resolution facsimile of the authentic document. Bisnow hopes these two Fulton finds will stir the interest and the help of many caretakers of the nation's paper trails. Archivists tend to know the value of what they have, he says. They've been waiting for somebody to come looking for it. And a sidebar, before Fulton filed these two critical patents, one of his early boats made the 150-mile trip from New York to Albany in 32 hours, a trip that took conventional sloops 4 days. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I sure enjoyed reading it for you. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian readings are available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions for us, please call at 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.